Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 podcast network podcast. You can go over to 1517.org/podcast, check out all the other podcasts that are part of that big family. Also, while you're over at 1517, you can go to the events page. You can find the Here We Still Stand link. We're exactly, from the time this releases, we're 3 weeks out. 3 weeks we'll be in San Diego. There's a handful, and I mean just a few tickets left. Might not even be there by this point, but if they are, you go ahead and grab them up, especially if you're local in California. You want to be one of the last ones in. You can do that. Also, speaking of events, we got an exciting event that we're going to be a part of. The registration just opened, and since I know, because I've seen the data, that we have listeners all over Europe, Germany specifically. We're going to be in Germany, me, Chad, Eric, Scott Keys, a whole bunch of other people that we're excited to meet. We're going to be at the Great Freedom Conference in Hamburg, Germany. I'll put a link in the show notes so you can go to the website, you can register. Hey, if you're in Germany or if you're in traveling distance to Germany, I know how this works over there in Europe. I know that you can get from Ireland to Germany or Scotland to Germany. That's just like me going down to Texas to visit Chad. It's even less than that, I think.
Yeah, probably is.
This is a small area that you guys are living in. Come see us. We're going to be at the Great Freedom Conference. That's in May of next year.
Yeah, it's going to be cool. I can't wait.
Yeah, it's going to be a good time.
Yeah.
Chad, what else is going on?
Well, speaking of travel, I'm heading up to Damascus, Oregon, right outside Portland this weekend. If you're in that area, come join us. Be kind of last minute if you don't know about it already, but I'll be at Christ the Vine Lutheran Church in Damascus. I think we're starting around 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock on Saturday morning. Anyway, all the information is on the 1570 website, or you can check out my Facebook page. I've got a link posted there for the details. So yeah, if you're in that area, the country, then come out and join us. We'll be talking about something that evidently you're interested in because you're listening to this podcast, talk about the scandalous grace of God in the lives of some Old Testament characters. So if you're free Saturday, come see us.
Yeah, I'll put a link to the event page on 1517 in the show notes too, so you can just click on that if you want to know where it is and all that.
Yeah, good deal. Good deal.
All right, so we've made it to chapter 3 of Joshua. We're so far we've done one chapter per episode. We'll see if we can pick up the pace a little bit.
Yeah, I think we're going to try to today we're going to try and cover two chapters because Joshua 3 and 4 are one big unit. I guess they divided the chapter because if they hadn't of, it would have been like a super long chapter. I'm not sure, but that could be the only reason because there really is no break in the narrative. It goes from the kind of preparation period for crossing the Jordan River until they actually cross the Jordan River and finally set foot in the Promised Land. Of course, along with that, we have a lot of emphasis upon the Ark of the Covenant and these stones, these actually two sets of 12 stones that are part of the, I guess you might call the iconography of the event, the image that's associated with it. So there's a lot that's going on in this particular story. Because it, in many ways, is the counterpart to the crossing of the Red Sea. And we'll unpack that a little bit as we get into the narrative. But anyway, it is all one enclosed story between Joshua 3:1 and Joshua 4:24. So a lot of good stuff.
Chad, you should never try to figure out why they did the chapter divisions the way they did. I've given up on this because I find that there is some chapters that you have no idea, why'd you make this both these chapters so short? Why isn't this just one thing? Then you have other issues where they're like absolutely have a super long chapter, and then you have something like this where like they probably just should have let it go and they didn't. So yeah. I don't know what the madness behind this method was, but I've given up trying to figure out what exactly they're doing.
Well, you know that things were not going to be perfect when they can't even get the very first chapter of the Bible right.
Right.
I mean, right? Like, so the creation account does not end at the end of Genesis 1. It ends at the fourth verse of chapter 2. I mean, it's obvious. I mean, you don't even get to the Sabbath day in Genesis 1. So they can't even get the first chapter of the Bible divided rightly as far as the narrative as a whole. I'm sure it's nothing but a legend, but it actually actually makes sense that was it Stephen Langton? Is he the one that made these divisions? Anyway, whoever did it, the story I heard was that sometimes he made these divisions in the text when he was like riding a horse, and the horse would like stumble. He like put the division to the wrong place. Well, it's probably legend, but actually it makes sense when you look at some of these weird and irrational chapter divisions we have in the Bible.
Oh, I did. Anyway, there's some that are it's so weird when this is in the New Testament too. We actually just experienced this where, you know, besides the chapter division, sometimes you'll have like chapter headings and then you have other headings within the chapter, and a chapter will end in the New Testament, like a Pauline epistle will end, and then like the next chapter will start and be a chapter heading with one verse and then another heading, because that verse is completing the thought of the previous chapter. And you're like, okay, yeah, you literally started this chapter one verse too early.
Yeah. It is one of those, I don't know if I pointed out this out in the podcast or not. I know I have in classes that I've taught, but the book that we hold in our hands, or I know people hold their phone in their hands now, but stick with me here. The book we hold in our hands, which is just an English translation of the Bible, is already interpreted in multitudes of ways. The translation is part interpretation, and the division is also part of the interpretation. But because, of course, how it's divided up in not only chapters but also even verses, that affects the way that we perceive the story and thus affects our interpretation of it. So it's already like several stages into interpretation.
Yeah,
by the time you're actually holding the Bible.
Yeah, my rule is if a chapter starts with the word therefore, you done messed up.
Right. Yeah, you know it's building on something. Okay, well, that's a little a foray into some of the history of the Bible, I suppose. All right, so let's jump in here and see what we got coming up. So this is the whole thing is about the crossing of the Jordan, and I've debated exactly how to tackle this. I guess we'll read the first few verses just to kind of get us in. It gets us into the story. And then we might skip around a little bit, because this is one of those narratives where there's several times where verses or ideas or actions are repeated, and you have multiple themes that are voiced multiple times. So we'll get into the story, and then we might jump around a little bit. So let me read the first few verses. Then Joshua rose early in the morning. He and all the sons of Israel set out from Shittim and came to the Jordan. And they lodged there before they crossed. And it came about at the end of 3 days that the officers went through the midst of the camp. And they commanded the people, saying, when you see the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord your God with the Levitical priest carrying it, then you shall set out from your place and go after it. However, there shall be between you and it a distance of about 2,000 cubits by measure. Do not come near it, that you may know the way by which you shall go, for you have not passed this way before. Then Joshua said to the people, consecrate yourselves, for tomorrow the Lord will do wonders among you. And Joshua spoke to the priests, saying, take up the Ark of the Covenant and cross over ahead of the people. So they took up the Ark of the Covenant and went ahead of the people. Now the Lord said to Joshua, this day I will begin to exalt you in the sight of all Israel, that they may know that just as I have been with Moses, I will be with you. You shall moreover command the priests who are carrying the Ark of the Covenant, saying, when you come to the edge of the waters of the Jordan, you shall stand still in the Jordan. Okay, that takes us through the first eight verses. We'll stop there for a minute and talk about a few of the details that have emerged so far. One of the things that first jumped out to me, and maybe this is because I was checking out these verses in the original in Hebrew, is that there's a lot of language here that is kind of like this neon language. It's just like glowing. It's like catching your attention and drawing that attention to earlier narratives. Because if you look at the Hebrew of just like verse one about rising early in the morning, and this language of coming to a body of water and lodging and crossing, all of this particular language, whether it's a verb or whether it's a noun, is hearkening back to a lot of previous narratives. Everything from all the times that the Israelites set out, which literally in the Hebrew is pull up stakes. I guess we still use that. We still use that metaphor, not often, but sometimes in English about, you know, you're moving from one place to another. So you're pulling up stakes. Well, literally in the Hebrew, that's what the verb is for set out. So, and for them, it's not so much a metaphor as a reality. You're living in tents. The tents are staked down. So you pull up the stakes in order to move from one location to another. So they pulled up stakes. They come to a body of water. We've encountered that before. And we'll talk about that more as we go through the narrative. And we have this language of lodging as well. And of course, that is what the Israelites have been doing for a very, very long time. We'll be in a place for a while. They'll pull up stakes. They'll move somewhere else. They'll lodge there for a while. They'll pull up stakes. They'll move somewhere else. So the reason I bring this out is because what you see happening in Joshua 3 and 4 is kind of a pulling together of a whole lot of different themes that we have developed in the Torah and that are now coming to their fulfillment. Everything from the travel to the crossing to what God is going to do miraculously at this body of water. Of course, we have the Ark of the Covenant as well as the priesthood active here. So this beginning of the narrative is already, by the use of the language that's describing what's happening with Israelites, already linking us back to earlier narratives as a way of winking at us about the connection between these two things. And we also have, throw this out there, this is verse 2, this language of 3 days. You know, in the Gospels, we have, it perplexes people sometimes because there'll be this language of 3 days connection with Christ's death and resurrection. And it'll say this happened, this 3 days, in fulfillment of the scriptures. And what the reason it's perplexing is because if you look in the Old Testament for like some messianic prophecy that says the Messiah will rise again in 3 days, well, you're going to be looking a long time because it's not there. There is no like explicit prophecy in the Old Testament of some 3-day interval between the death and the resurrection of Jesus, at least not in that particular language. But what you do, the reason it says this happens in fulfillment of the scriptures is because you have the theme of 3 days as a description of the period of time for waiting for God to do something big. You have that all over the Old Testament. I mean, whether it's a 3 days journey, for instance, that Abraham takes with Isaac to Mount Moriah, where the sacrifice is going to take place, or whether it's there's a 3 days reference back in Exodus chapter, it's either 19 or 20, when the Israelites are waiting for the theophany that's going to happen at Mount Sinai, or the language of Hosea about God reviving us on the third day. I mean, there's a whole long list of these. It just go to like Bible Hub sometime and type in 3 days, search that, or type in third day, search that. And it's going to come up over and over in the Old Testament. What happens is this becomes the Old Testament's way of designating the period of time in which you're waiting for God to accomplish some big thing, to do some great wonder, or even to have some kind of unexpected reversal take place, as you see in the case of Genesis 22 and Abraham and Isaac. So here too, when we have this language of 3 days, about they're supposed to wait for 3 days, that's part of this very vast use in the Old Testament of the 3-day imagery. And that is, if you ever wonder, okay, what's this according to the scriptures that the New Testament talks about in connection with the resurrection of Christ and the period of time? Well, that's it. That's the Old Testament background of that particular time period.
Sometimes God will go to extremes to make you wait 3 days, like having you sit around in the belly of a great fish.
Yeah, that's another one. Exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, that of course, fits with that whole theme, right? Yeah, you're waiting.
You're doing nothing but waiting.
You're doing nothing but waiting. I mean, there's not a whole lot you can do when you're belly of a fish. So whether you're like there underwater, or you're at the foot of a mountain, or as in Joshua, you're at the bank of a river, you're waiting. And you know, when you think about it, that is typically the way that God works. you know, it's pretty rare to get kind of a microwavable divine action. It doesn't happen fast. Usually you're just kind of waiting for God to do something. I mean, we have all experienced that. In fact, it seems like it's taking God forever to do certain things, but he rarely gets in a hurry. We get in a hurry all the time, especially these days, but God really does. He bides his time.
But this is one of the reasons why when Jesus over and over and over says, like, I'm going to go, I'm going to be killed, and then on the third day, I'll rise again. He's talking to a bunch of Hebrews. The disciples are exclusively Jewish, and this shouldn't be like some crazy, you know, third day. Never heard that before. Like, right. You know, they should know this. I mean, it makes total sense. He's like, I'm going to die. But then after you're waiting for 3 days, I'm going to be alive again. And this should make sense. And it is interesting how the women do go to the tomb on the third day, but not really expecting anything.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah, I guess they were just so bewildered. If they'd have been thinking about the Torah, then they might have had some, or just actually listened to what Jesus has said, that'd have a very good idea of what was going to happen that third day.
Yeah, I mean, it's still sort of like, maybe it's just like ingrained in the DNA. They're like, well, when do you want to go? I don't know. Maybe we'll wait 3 days and we'll go.
Yeah, right. So we see in these opening couple of verses, whether it's getting up early in the morning, or setting out, pulling up stakes, or the 3 days. There's a lot of language here or phrases here that we're going to see repeated throughout the rest of the scriptures. So here's basically the command. After these 3 days, here's what's going to happen. You're going to see the priest take up the Ark of the Covenant, and they're going to march ahead of you. And Joshua says that what you need to do is, first of all, be ready. That's basically what he's saying about as far as like consecrate yourselves. That is to say, don't do anything during those 3 days that in some way is going to make you ritually impure and unable to participate fully in what's about to happen. So get ready, be prepared, because here's what God is about to do. So the priest will take up the ark, and you're going to follow behind, but not like close behind. You're going to be 2,000 cubits, which I guess is like close to half a mile or something like that. It's a significant distance anyway between you and the ark. So they don't. There's always, this is part of what we've seen with the ark before. There's always a distance between the Ark of the Covenant and everybody else. Even the highest echelon, I mean, even the high priest only gets close, really close to the Ark once a year. In fact, the priests carrying the Ark of the Covenant here probably get just about as close as any person possibly can to the Ark itself. Because there's, as you remember, when the Ark was constructed, it was constructed with rings on either side of it, four rings, I guess, on the four corners, and poles were inserted into these. And so that's the way the ark was transported. So there's always a distance, at least between most of Israel and the Ark of the Covenant. So they take the ark, and everybody follows behind it because they don't know for sure which way they're supposed to go. And so the ark is going to lead the way. So this is actually nothing new. I mean, in some ways it is, but the image of the ark leading Israel is something that we've seen multiple times, because it was the ark that led them to the point where they now are. Over and over, when it was time for them to pull up stakes and to move from one place to another, the whole tabernacle had to be unassembled, packed up. All of the utensils had to be prepared for the travel, and the ark itself would have led the way. In fact, since we're talking about that, let me go back here to Numbers chapter 10 and read you three or four verses here. So this is this is Numbers 10, 33 through 36. It says, "Thus they set out from the mount of the Lord, 3 days' journey. So this is when they're finally, this is after, so they go to Sinai after the after leaving Egypt. They go to Sinai. They stay there for a long, long time, over a year. And now they're finally leaving. So they're pulling up stakes. They're journeying. And here's how it's described. They set out for the mount of the Lord, 3 days' journey. There's that 3 days again. With the ark of the covenant of the Lord journeying in front of them for the 3 days to seek out a resting place for them. Now, that's some pregnant language there, because what we see happening in Numbers 10:33 is now finally going to be brought to its conclusion in the book of Joshua. Notice it says it's seeking out a resting place for them. Well, in some ways, it did find that. It did find places to rest along the way. But the true resting place was going to be when they entered, of course, into the Holy Land. So the Ark of God is journeying ahead of the Israelites to find a resting place for them. And it finally does here in Joshua chapter 3 and 4. Let me read on. And the cloud of the Lord was over them by day when they set out from the camp. Then it came about when the ark set out that Moses said, and we have a little bit of poetry here. So I'm assuming this was some sort of chant, anthem that was sung by the Israelites. Now listen to the language. This is critical for understanding what's happening in Joshua. They say, "Rise up, O Lord, and let your enemies be scattered, and let those who hate you flee before you." And when the ark came to rest, he said, "Return, O Lord, to the myriad thousands of Israel." Now that verse 35 is significant. It says, "Rise up." This is when the ark is setting out. "Rise up, O Lord, let your enemies be scattered, and let those who hate you flee before you." So the ark is connected with not only the presence of God and journeying, but also with the conquest of enemies, which of course is what's about to happen in the rest of the book of Joshua. So the ark isn't there just as a guide, nor is it there just as an emblem of a visible emblem of the invisible presence of God. It's also there as sort of the, I don't know what you'd call it, so sort of like the emblem of upcoming victory over enemies. Something like that. It's signaling not only the presence of God, but also has sort of this military significance. Like it's the true army, if you will. It's scattering the enemies of Israel before them. Those who hate them are fleeing before the ark. So what is talked about way back in Numbers chapter 10 about the ark leading them and the ark guiding them into a new place, a resting place, and scattering the enemies, that kind of language, which was applicable back in Numbers 10, is truly applicable here in Joshua 3 and 4. This is when it's actually going to be seen most apparently. Okay, so they take up the ark, and then we have a verse 7. We have one of the verses that says expressly why God is doing what he's doing. That is the question that you have to ask here, because presumably, even though the waters were deep, they could have found a place to ford the river at this time of year. So this isn't just for practicality purposes. In other words, God isn't just like making it easy for them to get across the Jordan River. We do know the waters were deep because this was the springtime. This was during barley harvest. And every year what happens is the snows that melt at the very beginning of the Jordan River, they, as those snows melt, then flow down the Jordan, there's a lot of flooding that happens. So it was time of year, and so the waters were deeper than normal, but presumably there would have been some way that Israel could have gotten across the river. So this isn't done just to help them get across the river. There's a far more important reason or reasons that God is doing what he's doing. And one of these is, as I said, in verse 7. God says to Joshua, "This day I will begin to exalt you in the sight of all Israel, that they may know that just as I have been with Moses, I will be with you." So just like at the crossing of the Red Sea, we saw that the people not only believed in God, but they believed in Moses. So they trusted in him as their divinely appointed leader. So now this is going to be God's occasion to do the exact same thing for Joshua. This is going to be the way in which God elevates Joshua as the new Moses, as the one who is going to stand in the shoes of Moses and take over the leadership of the nation. So this is God's way of putting his imprimatur very visibly and very unforgettably upon Joshua.
Yeah, if you think about it, it's got to be a freaky thing for them to have the Moses actually die. I mean, they're rebellious and stiff-necked people or whatever, but when Moses dies, that does have to be freaky, because when push came to shove, he was sort of the instrument used to bring about deliverance and provision. You know, I mean, he's the one that's saying, hey, stuff's going to come out of the sky for you to eat. You know, he's the one that's, you know, there for the Red Sea thing. He's the one that is like smacking the rock or speaking to the rock or whatever he's doing to the rock. He's the one throwing branches into water and making it sweet. So, I mean, when he's gone, you might be like, well, I'm not thrilled about this 40 years in the wilderness thing that he's been taking us on, but I'm really freaked out that he's not around, because like we'd all be dead right now if he hadn't been around.
Yeah, I mean, he's a known quantity, right?
Yeah.
People know Moses, and he's the only leader that they've ever known. I mean, this is by far a perfect analogy, but just imagine if you're however old, you're 20 or you're 40 years old, whatever, and you've only known one president. I mean, your whole life, there's only been one, you know, of course it wouldn't be like that in the United States, but just suppose you've only known one president. Well, you know, yeah, you're going to know him pretty well. You can know his strengths and his weaknesses, and he's very much a known quantity. But all of a sudden, if he dies and somebody new's coming along, it's like, well, what in the world is this going to be like? You know, everything that we've known is now going to be different. You know, is he going to be able to do the exact same things that the previous leader did? Is he going to be strong enough? What's it going to be like? So you have that, but you also have psychologically just all of the, you know, the change that's about to take place. Everything's going to be different for the Israelites now. So I'm sure that, you know, they're stressed out, they're nervous, so they're also excited at the same time. And having something new, like a new leader thrown in there, just is going to make things even more kind of perplexing for a while.
Yeah, anytime you have like sort of this mono leader thing, it's freaky. I mean, Israel will experience this over and over again with kings, but yeah, if you have a king and that guy dies and he's been the king for however long, you're totally freaked out, because the next guy is probably going to, who knows how long he's going to be there. It's not like they have elections or they have term limits.
Right.
So you're like, I don't know if this is going to be good. Every time one king, if a good king dies, you're like, I don't know, man. Like, what if this new guy, you know, what if his son is a total, you know, a total freak? Like, this would be bad, and it's going to be bad for a while.
Yeah, well, it was like that with Solomon. Solomon was a good king in many ways, but he was also taxed the hell out of people.
Yeah.
So I'm sure there were a lot of, you know, and made him work, all these huge building projects. So he's making his citizens work. And so, yeah, I mean, there were a lot of good things, but a lot of bad things too. And then his son comes along, Rehoboam, and everyone's like, I wonder what's going to be like with him. Maybe we should ask him to lower our taxes, be a little nicer than Solomon. And Rehoboam comes along. He's like, oh, you thought it was bad under my dad. Well, I'll show you. Got all this youthful arrogance going on, and ends up splitting Israel into two different kingdoms. So you never know what's going to
happen. Yeah, this is before they're like, well, we'll only have to put up with it for 4 years and we'll just vote him out.
Yeah.
They're like, last time we tried to raise an insurrection against the leader, the ground opened up and ate a bunch of us. So.
Right. Yeah, not a good idea. Don't want that happening again. So what happens next? I guess we got to keep moving if we're going to finish this. So I'm gonna start summarizing a little bit of the story here, and we'll pick up some of the details. So Joshua tells them, here's what's going to happen. So the priests had the ark, and when they get to the edge of the Jordan, when their feet go into the water, then we're going to have the Red Sea part two happen. But instead of the waters just kind of forming a wall on either side of them, it's going to be a little bit different, because the waters are actually going to form a heap a lot further up. I can't remember the mileage here, but there's a place called Adam or Adam spelled exactly the same as the Adam we know from the opening chapters of Genesis. There's a place called that, and the waters formed a heap way up there. So this isn't just like 50 yards or 100 yards or even a mile from where Israel crossed the Jordan River. This is way upstream. And of course, it's different too, because when you're crossing the Red Sea, you're crossing a sea. And so you got walls of water on either side of you. It's not like that. So there's like a divine dam, if you will, that forms much further up the river that blocks these waters. And when that happens, Israel is going to cross over the Jordan River. And it says they did this in a hurry. They weren't just kind of, you know, lollygagging around. They got over the river in a hurry. But that wasn't all that was going to take place. Joshua also says that he's going to take one guy from each of the tribes of Israel, and each guy is going to take a rock, presumably a pretty big rock. I'm guessing one, you know, just as big as he could carry. And they're going to take this out of the Jordan and carry it with them on the other side. And they're going to set these up as a memorial to visually document what happened at the crossing of the Jordan. So this is referred to probably three or four times in these two chapters about this is going to take place, and then this does take place, and this is why it takes place. But then we're also surprised, because after all of this talk about these 12 guys taking these 12 stones out of the Jordan, setting them up on the other side of the Jordan, all of a sudden, we realize that Joshua is going to do his own thing too, because this is in chapter 4. I can't find the verse right now. Oh, verse 9. Yeah, so Joshua has kind of his own thing that's going to do. So he takes 12 stones, just him, and he sets them up in the middle of the river. So this is kind of confusing when you're first reading through this story. You're like, wait, are the 12 stones in the river? Are the 12 stones like taken out of the river and taken to the other side? Well, yes, you got two piles of stones. So 12 guys take two stones, set them up as a memorial on the Holy Land side of the Jordan. And then Joshua takes 12 stones and sets them up in the middle of the Jordan as sort of a monument or a memorial right there in the river itself as a memory of what happened at the crossing. So after the priests stand there, they cross over on dry ground, they do the whole stone thing, all Israel goes through, then the priests walk out of the Jordan River, and the waters are released, and the waters return to their ordinary levels. So that's kind of the story. If you're not familiar with it, or if it's been a while since you read it, that's everything that happens there. Now, let's kind of delve a little bit in the time that we have left into kind of the theological significance of some of this. I love to refer to the crossing of the Jordan when it comes time to talk about the baptism of Jesus. And not only to link these two stories, but also to pull in some other narratives as well. Because here's the way I think that we should think of the Jordan. First of all, it's typical Old Testament stuff to talk about the theological significance of geography. So you see this throughout the Old Testament where geography is theology. We've seen this multiple times already, whether it's Egypt, whether it's the wilderness, whether it's the Red Sea, Mount Sinai, all these various locations where different things happen, like Marah and Meribah, these places of trying and testing. So as one author I read somewhere put it, that Israel puts its sin on the map. It not only puts its sin on the map, though, it also puts God's salvation on the map, so that geography always has this theological message that's connected with it when it comes to the scriptures. Well, what's the theological message of the Jordan? Well, if I were to summarize it, it'd be this, that the Jordan is the place where the old gives way to the new. So the Jordan is like this liminal space, this place where there's going to be a transition between what was and what now is. You certainly see this in Joshua 3 and 4. So here you have the sons of Israel. They had been promised the Holy Land. They've been waiting. And now finally, they leave behind that old. They leave behind the promise and they come into reality. They leave behind the waiting and they come into the fulfillment. But this is the only story we have that happening. You also have this happening in the case of Naaman. Remember the Syrian general who has leprosy? He comes to seek out healing and the prophet tells him, well, go wash in the Jordan. And of course, he doesn't want to at first, but he finally does. And what happens? His skin is restored like that of a little child. And so, and then he not only that, he's not just healed, but then he goes on to confess that Yahweh is the only true God of heaven and earth. So Naaman leaves behind the old, leaves behind leprosy, leaves behind paganism, and enters into cleansing, into healing, and into the confession of the one true God. Same thing happens with Elijah and Elisha. When Elijah is about to be taken up into heaven, it's like we have Joshua 3 repeated again, because Elijah and Elisha go to the Jordan, and Elijah strikes the Jordan River with his cloak, the waters split, and they cross over on dry ground. And then after that, Elijah, of course, is taken up into heaven. So it's a transition from an earthly life to a heavenly life for Elijah. And there's a transition between Elijah being the prophet of Israel to Elisha being the prophet of Israel. So with all that kind of as a background, when you get to the Gospels and the baptism of Jesus, you understand that there's really one and only one place in the land of Israel where the Messiah can be baptized. It's got to be at the Jordan, because the whole Old Testament history has set us up for that to happen, because it's here where John gives way to Jesus, where there it happens there on the border between the wilderness and the promised land. And so this is the way in which God is bringing about a new Israel in fulfillment of his promise through the Messiah. This is where Christ begins to take on our sin by putting himself into the water, fulfilling all righteousness. So the Jordan is not just like one option among many where Jesus could have been baptized. There's a reason John went to the Jordan River to baptize instead of anywhere else. Not just because there was a lot of water there, but because this is where he was standing as the prophet between the old and the new. He was standing in this wet liminal space because this was where Israel would now, through baptism, in preparation for the Messiah, enter into the promise of the Messiah that's about to be fulfilled. So the Jordan becomes this theological, weighty place, already beginning with Joshua and then continuing on the rest of these Old Testament stories.
Yeah, I mean, John showing up in the Jordan baptizing. You know, another thing that's interesting about that, by the way, if you want to take the academy class, I do start with the last two verses of the Old Testament, are "I will send you Elijah." Mm-hmm. Now, of course, Jesus says, "This is John. If you're willing to accept it, this is John the Baptist." And again, you have this thing where John shows up in the Jordan that Elijah throw his cloak down and then gets sucked into heaven. And the reason, you know, people are even thinking like, oh, well, maybe someday Elijah will come back. People wonder if he was Elijah because he doesn't die. So when a guy doesn't die, you assume he might return. And then all of a sudden here comes this guy and he's in the Jordan. That's where he shows up. He's like, he shows up in the Jordan. And there's all kinds of crazy stuff that goes on with the Jordan.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it really is. I mean, it's super significant. And it just to reiterate one more time, it's why paying attention to where things happen is so important in the scriptures. I think that just the reason I stress that is because I don't think it's something that we think about as much today. I mean, we associate certain things happening in certain places, but in the scriptures, not only do you have that happening, like important things happening in certain places, but usually those important things at those specific places repeat themselves, or they're connected in some way with a previous event or a future event. And just to kind of finish it up there, that is really what happens here with the crossing of the Jordan. This is the crossing of the sea for this new generation of Israelites, except this time they don't have an enemy army hot on their heels. They're not scared. They're not like crying out, oh, we're going to die. Why'd you bring us out in the wilderness? You know, God must hate us. So they're none of that's going on. Instead, it's a very different atmosphere because now they're about to cross over into the land of their enemies. And they're not doing so in fear. They're actually crossing over to conquer. So it's very different. It's not a bunch of recently escaped slaves cowering in fear thinking they're about to die. And then God all of a sudden parts the Red Sea and they cross over. It's very different. Now you have a different generation. They're ready to do what God tells them to do. They're led by a new man, and they're entering into finally the land of promise. So it's similar to the crossing of the Red Sea. That's explicit in chapter 4, verse 23. They are connected, but this is a very different kind of crossing. It's a crossing no longer out of fear, but actually out of hope and faith into what awaits them.
Well, this is the difference between crossing the Red Sea with Moses and crossing the Jordan with Joshua. And these are very different things, because you might know that crossing the Red Sea with the law is different than crossing the Jordan with Jesus.
That's the perfect way to end.
There it is. All right, yeah. Guys. Thanks for listening. Podcast has been helpful to you. You can go over to 1517.org, go to the donate page. You can become a contributor. It is people like you that make it possible. Thank you so much to those of you who support it. Chad, I will see you next week.
All right. See you here.